Welcome to another episode of the Maine Humanities Council's Humanities on Demand podcast series. This episode features Don Dearborn. His lecture, How Darwin's Mind Worked, was part of the first annual Dorothy Schwartz Forum on Art, Science, and the Humanities. It was held on November 15, 2014, and focused on the topic, Why Darwin Matters. Don Dearborn is an evolutionary biologist and chair of the biology department at Bates College. He has published extensively on how evolution shapes the behavior of animals, including deception, retaliation, and reproductive parasitism.
So at the brainstorming stage for this event, when I was talking with Gina and talking with Charles, Charles asked me the question that he asked Bernd a little bit ago of sort of what relevance does Darwin have to you or to biologists now? What influence does he have? How much do you think about him? And I didn't think about that a ton at the time. I didn't have a real easy answer. But as I get ready to tell you a bit about Darwin's ideas, I think the answer is that I'm not a historian. I'm not a historian of science or of people. But I know about Darwin a bit, and what I do know is because of his biology. So I have some context in which to think about the work that I do. Sort of in the way that Bernd was saying, you know, that physicists, of course, if they haven't read Newton lately, Newton is still foundational. Darwin is foundational, but he also, from a methodological standpoint, as you'll see, I think is a great example of what interdisciplinary science is like now. So let me start maybe by telling you sort of my early interest in evolutionary biology. I think like a lot of people, as a kid, I was outside a lot. My folks, you know, took us camping and paid attention to birds and other things around. And then in junior high, sort of by the usual weird set of circumstances, I wound up in this program at a natural history museum in North Carolina and got really quickly sucked into this world of chasing salamanders, but chasing salamanders with a little more structure and purpose and trying to help people answer science questions. And so this from this museum newsletter from forever ago where we were coming out of doing a mammal survey in these sort of impenetrable habitats in the coastal plain. And beyond that, we did the usual, you know, cataloging of museum records. I remember spending months going through these filing cabinets of reports from citizens of their claims to have seen or heard or encountered a mountain lion in North Carolina. And so my task was to kind of sort them by likelihood of some kernel of truth to them. And did they really see a dog? Did they really see their neighbor and they'd had a bit to drink? Did they see a bobcat and they just were so frightened and startled that they imagined it was four times as large? And so this kind of natural history and anecdote and correspondence bit that played such a central role in Darwin's thinking was something that came across my radar at sort of an early age. I obviously also got interested in the Galapagos, was lucky to go there not too long ago, and did some things Darwin did and some things Darwin probably did not do. So before thinking a bit more explicitly about Darwin and sort of what shaped his thinking and the things he did or didn't do in the Galapagos and elsewhere, I just want to be sure we're on the same wavelength about what evolution by natural selection is. And so just in a nutshell, here's the recap. You have to have heritable variation between individuals. There is, in some fashion, differential survival or differential reproductive success of different individuals that is non-random with respect to some, at least, of those heritable variations. And as a consequence of that, the traits that are successful are going to be more common in the next generation. So the heritability thing is obviously really crucial. If you've got a snowshoe hare running away from a lynx, if that hare is fast, then hares in the next generation will be faster on average, but only if that hare is fast for genetic reasons. If that hare is fast because it's over-caffeinated, then that doesn't, nothing changes, right? There's no intergenerational effect unless there's a genetic predisposition to caffeination. And if you, sort of at the risk of belaboring it too much, the lemming thing, there's a lemming, you can see there's one lemming wearing a life jacket as they're all racing towards the water. So that's probably not a heritable trait, but if it were a heritable trait to wear a life jacket, or maybe that's just some weird morphological change, then lemmings with life jackets are probably going to be more common in the next generation. the subtle point there is that lemming is doing something maybe innovative, and so it's also possible that innovation is a trait that is going to be favored from one generation to the next in this circumstance. You can imagine other circumstances where innovation leads to terrible outcomes. So natural selection, it's easy to say, okay, survival of the fittest, I get what fittest is, it's the ones that are fast and get away from the bad guys. But sometimes it's much more subtle than that, and the circumstances that favor or don't favor certain traits change in time and in space. Okay, so the basic concept here is simple in hindsight, but obviously it was the subject of really meticulous accrual of evidence over a lifetime. Really detailed work on very focused kinds of organisms, earthworms, whole book about earthworms, a book about orchids, all his work on pigeons, really, really detailed. So I won't go far into this, but just to remind you back to this morning, to Janet's talk about his context and the world in which he was thinking and working, just as a few examples of the kinds of things that influenced him. Malthus, she mentioned. So Malthus's book on human population growth and the resulting consequences of a large growing population really were important to him. Geology, Charles Lyell was someone he looked up to, and also someone, as Janet said, he took Lyell's 1830 book series on the beagle. And one of the really key points there was this idea of uniformitarianism. That is, that the geological processes that are happening now are the same ones that were happening in the past. And you don't have a special creation stage and a catastrophic destruction event and then different processes now. And so if it's a uniform process, then you can make better and more reasoned inferences about fossils and about things that happened in the past, when you can sort of frame an understanding of how those rock layers came to be the way they are. His wife, Emma Wedgwood Darwin, obviously there's a lot of interesting conversation about the role of her religion. She was certainly more religious than he was. There's also maybe some sense that she was not too eager to bend to authority, so maybe some conflicting pressures that people have tried to interpret. This is not an area I know about, but interesting push and pull there on his, not his science ideas, but what to do with his science ideas. And then his grandfather, Erasmus, who was a physician, a philosopher, a naturalist. So tons of other influences, but again, just to sort of have the context there. So with that little backdrop, I'll talk to you about four things to give a sense of how he approached his work and how it has fared since then. So you know, you all know the basic scientific method, right? You've got an observation that you make either in the field, as Bernd was discussing, in the lab, somewhere. You derive a hypothesis from that, and then you set out to test it in some more structured way, use your data, draw a conclusion, and then revise your hypothesis or repeat that. So for Darwin, that early process obviously led to a somewhat difficult place. It led to a conclusion that to him eventually seemed inescapable, but that he knew was going to be a tough sell for a wide audience. So his response to that was to keep collecting data. His response to that was essentially, I'm going to beat them to death with, you just build this unassailable case, more data, more data, more data. And then you lay out the argument and you reinforce the argument, and boy, his writing compared to Wallace's, they are sort of night and day in terms of the amount of detail and the reiteration. And it didn't stop when he published, because as I'll show you in a sec, Origen went through revision after revision. He just was not satisfied until he had as convincing and correct an argument as he felt like he could build. So I'll talk a little, before I get to revising, about the methods he used. And this is interesting to modern scientists, I think, and hopefully will be to you, as a sense of the diversity of approaches that he used. He used the fossil record in a lot of ways. It really influenced his thinking, and part of this was very direct. So when he was on the Beagle voyage in South America, he dug up fossils himself. So he's got this very firsthand experience with what they look like when they come out of the ground and with the reality of them. It's easier to doubt something that you haven't seen yourself, right? So even if someone can hand you a fossil and say, this is a fossil, if you dug it out of the ground, that somehow just brings it home. And people that are teachers know this. And so you use demonstrations and you take students places. So seeing this for Darwin and doing this himself was important. He excavated a giant ground sloth. But the other thing that he did that was really pivotal with fossils was comparing extinct forms to present forms. So the glyptodont armadillo pairing that was shown to you earlier today. If those fossil things really don't exist now, and that was a point of some argument amongst people in his time, if they don't exist now, and what does exist now is something that looks kind of like it but different, then you've got this, it becomes hard to hew to this idea of immutability. He also did experiments. And as I'll come back to in a second, this idea of mortality and population growth was really central to the strength of natural selection. So in this case, that's not Darwin's thumb, obviously, but it's the kind of experiment that he did. And so one that he describes is he's interested in the effect of predation on plant mortality, and he wants to separate out mortality that comes from competition. So he's got an area of ground that's 3 feet by 2 feet or something like that, and he wants to monitor seedling death, and he doesn't want it to be due to death from competition from adult plants, and so he just rips up all the adult plants, marks all the seedlings, and then follows their fate over time. And he followed the 357 seedlings in this little plot, and 295 of them were eaten by things, mainly by slugs, which couldn't have been fast, and by insects. And so he's got now some empirical evidence about the pressure that's on these things, not just from other plants, but from animals. He also reconstructed evolutionary lineages. In this case, it was creating hypothetical or alternative evolutionary trees to illustrate different hypotheses about how lineages change through time. So this is, it's just sort of a cool thing to see and to know that it exists. This is from an 1860 letter from Darwin to the geologist Charles Lyell, and it lays out two different evolutionary trees for the relationship of placental mammals and marsupials. So this is a huge piece of the way people think about evolution now, is in this very explicit historical framework of what's the relationship among species and when did particular changes happen, and do certain changes co-occur with other certain changes, those kinds of questions. He also used modeling, and in this case to argue for the scope for showing that there has to be some kind of struggle for existence that limits populations. So the Malthusian view here, the struggle for existence is the doctrine of Malthus applied to the whole animal and vegetable kingdoms. And so to convince people that this pressure really is real, because you don't see, when we walk outside, you are not knee-deep in dead animals, right? Walking from here across to lunch, we don't get a sense that the world is driven by competition and death. But it is, we just don't see it that way, is essentially his point. So he took elephants as this modeling example because they were the slowest growing, slowest breeding thing he could think of, and just sort of on the back of an envelope essentially said, okay, let's start with two elephants, and let's plug in these very conservative values for slow growth, for slow age at first reproduction, for slow reproductive output. And if you do the math, then in something like 500 years, we've got 15 million elephants. So if the Earth is 6,000 years old and elephants were made at the beginning, how many elephants should we have now? He didn't make it that explicit, but that's the implication. We would be, more than knee-deep in elephants. And so then what if you extend that to rabbits? What if you extend that to bacteria? You can do some similar math about bacteria and figure out that in 48 hours, you could cover the planet up to your knees in bacteria. So the point is, mathematically, you can show people, even using the most conservative possible example, that there's lots and lots of successful reproduction and survival that's not happening. No matter what method he used, whether he did modeling or phylogenetic comparisons or experiments, he comes eventually to this big mass of data that tells a story that's not going to be well received. So he's got to think about how to effectively convince readers. So I'll talk a bit about strategies he used for swaying a reluctant audience. And these are not strategies that he identified explicitly generally, but things that in looking in hindsight you can sort of imagine were part of his thinking. So physicist Neil deGrasse Tyson is a very enthusiastic and funny ambassador for science. And you could say this about gravity, you could say it about climate change, you could say it about nanotechnology, you could say it about evolution. Darwin obviously didn't have the platform from which to use this approach. That wouldn't have helped his cause a lot. So I want to talk about a handful of strategies that I think he used. And one is easy to see, and that's that you anticipate what the objections are going to be, and then you sort of make your counterarguments in advance. Darwin wanted to do this in writing. He was not, as Janet said, he was not a very public person, and really worked from his study mostly after coming back from his Beagle trip. So he did not want to go out and engage people in public about this. Thomas Huxley did, and the Huxley-Wilberforce exchange that Janet alluded to has been talked about, and the exchange when something like Wilberforce saying to Huxley, is it on your grandfather's side or your grandmother's side that you claim descent from an ape? And Huxley saying, in essence, I'd rather claim descent from an ape than from someone who manipulates the facts to his own ends. And that ostensibly, the rumor is that that caused a woman in the audience to faint, which is sort of depicted. So Darwin wanted no part of that. But he wanted to head things off at the pass in his writing as much as he could. So socially, of course, the big stumbling block is religion, is this idea of unique creation, of immutability of species, that they're not changing from the time they're made until now. Data-wise, there's sort of three stumbling blocks. One is the problem of inheritance, of genetics, which he knew was central. Inheritance is central to his idea of how things work, but he doesn't know. No one knows, except Mendel, who was not known to, Mendel's work wasn't known then. So no one knows how inheritance really happens. The second problem is the rarity of transitional forms in the available fossil record. And the third is the amount of time that it would take for his process of gradual change to shape things the way that he argues they've been shaped. And so he devoted entire chapters of Origin of Species to this. Chapters really explicitly titled Difficulties on Theory, on the imperfection of the geological record, which was, in his view, the explanation for the rarity or lack of transitional forms. A second thing that he did was to really use the data set or the kind of data that would be most persuasive. And there's something a little counterintuitive about this, so I'll try to explain it in a roundabout way. A really perfect fit of form to function in animals or plants would seem like a great argument for the power of evolution. But it's also, as noted by Stephen Jay Gould, a great argument for intelligent design or special creation, for the idea that species were formed individually by a creator for particular lifestyle, particular habitat. So the idea of something being perfectly matched to its environment, what idea that supports depends on what idea you already believe, in a sense. So stronger support from evolution might come from an imperfect match of form to function, from some kind of making do or repurposing an existing trait for a new reason. So Darwin wrote about this repurposing. He wrote about orchid flowers that were modified for very particular pollination methods. He wrote about vestigial body parts, so an appendix, something that clearly used to have some function but doesn't and is greatly reduced in morphology or size as a consequence of that loss of function. So I'm illustrating this with frigate birds because I've spent a lot of years studying them. They're near and dear to my heart. Frigate bird feet look like this. They're very unseabird-like. Their legs are so short that you can't put regular bird bands on them. And the webbing on their feet is so reduced that it's almost not there. It doesn't look like it's terribly useful for much. And Darwin saw this in the Galapagos and wrote in some notes that weren't published his behavioral observations. So he says, the bird never touches the water with its feet. One is led to believe that the deeply indented web between its toes is of no more use to it than are the mammary glands in the male sex of certain animals or the shriveled wings beneath the wing cases firmly soldered together of some coleopterous beetles. So he gets this idea that vestigial things are really an argument for change over time. He also, I think, starts, in origin at least, starts the argument on what's sort of easy ground, and that is that the opening chapter is about variation under domestication. That's not what he's trying to explain. He's not trying to explain why we have these different breeds of cows. He's trying to explain natural variation in species and the origin of species. But this is a familiar inroad. It, in some ways, is a fairly agrarian society. There are a lot of people that have direct experience with different breeds of cows or of pigeons in Darwin's case, or of ducks, or of whatever. And so everybody can pretty easily agree that there's a lot of variety in these things. And Darwin sort of then makes the parallel to natural things and says at least a score of pigeons, that is of pigeon varieties, might be chosen, which if shown to an ornithologist and he were told that they were wild birds, would be ranked by him as well-defined species. So you start with this thing. Okay, we've got all these crazy different kinds of pigeons. To a biologist, if you were told that they were wild birds, you'd say they were different species. And then he moves on to say, to talk about how they got that way. And says, we cannot suppose that all the breeds were suddenly produced as perfect and as useful as we now see them. Indeed, in several cases, we know that this has not been their history. The key is man's power of accumulative selection. Nature gives successive variation. So here we are with the variation piece. Man adds them up in certain directions useful to him. In this sense, he may be said to make for himself useful breeds. And then the obvious next step is, well, if this is something that people can do just by picking the ones that we like best, the same thing is happening when you've got variation in traits in wild populations and it gets cold and the well-insulated ones live and the badly insulated ones die, or any other selection pressure you can imagine. So he's starting on ground that's really hard for people to reject. And then saying, well, the obvious implication of this is something that you might not be as happy about. So part of wanting to be right and part of wanting to be convincing from Darwin's standpoint, maybe from anybody's standpoint, includes always updating your arguments. And Darwin did this kind of a lot. Origin went through 6 editions, as Janet mentioned earlier, and they really were, in a lot of ways, substantively different from one another. So here are a couple of sort of interesting tidbits about some of them. The phrase survival of the fittest first appears in the 5th edition, borrowed from philosopher Herbert Spencer, whom Janet mentioned earlier today. The word evolution first appears in the 6th edition in 1872. It appeared a year before that in Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex, but that was not a word that he was using in his first few versions. This online tool, maybe everybody knows this, but all the complete works of Darwin are available online. You can get them in PDF or in HTML text. It's actually really great to have the piece of, like, have a book in front of you to read Darwin, but you can get any of it online. So the online site includes this very cool thing that I have to show you quickly called the Variorum. And the Variorum is just a way to let you look at differences between editions. So here we can say, well, I've got this passage that's on page 25 of the first edition, and I want to see how it's different in the 5th edition. And you can do that, and it pulls up on the right side the newer edition with the changes highlighted. So for anybody that likes reading Darwin and is interested in revision or just interested in what was happening at the time, it's a really cool thing to do. So as a reviser, and as you think about him as a reviser, you wonder what's motivating the revision. And I, not being a historian of Darwin, I don't know if people have written a lot about what motivated different parts of the changes that he made. But some of them you can infer, and some of them are curious. One of the ones that's interesting to me that I hadn't realized is this change in a really famous sentence that marks the very end of Origin. So the top is the first edition, the bottom is the second edition. And so there's grandeur in this view of life with its several powers having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one. And then he goes on talking about how all these things have evolved from it. And in the second edition, he inserts this explicit reference to the Creator having originally breathed life into this thing, having set the process in motion. So I don't know if that's a retreat based on pushback, or maybe it's just clarifying something that he had in his mind already. There are other cases where he clearly has new data. So I'll use this cuckoo example because this is another area that's of research interest to me is animals that are reproductive parasites of other animals. So brown-headed cowbirds in the U.S., European cuckoos in Europe, reproduce by laying their eggs in the nests of other species, right? And those other species unwittingly rear kids that aren't theirs, but aren't even the same kind of animal as themselves. And the cuckoo takes this to a little nastier extreme, where the cuckoo chick hatches first and then immediately pushes out all of the host's eggs. So Darwin was really interested in this and interested in how this came to be, and he outlines this interesting sort of verbal model, which is something like this. It might start with an event of parasitizing members of your own species, and maybe that's by an accident, but if that saves you from having to do the work of rearing those kids, then you could probably afford to have additional kids, and so that if that trait has a genetic basis, then you could imagine how it would spread quickly. What happens next evolutionarily depends on this key question of whether there are other species around that would be appropriate hosts. So appropriate in terms of not throwing your eggs out, having an incubation period that's about the same, feeding your kids the same kind of food so that your kids would survive there, all that stuff. So if the answer to that is no, then this parasitism just stays within your species, and therefore is necessarily an opportunistic process. But if the answer to that is yes, then you can start parasitizing other species. And Darwin didn't talk about this next step, but my interest here really comes in what happens then, and does that parasitism of other species stay facultative, stay opportunistic, or does it become your only mode of reproducing? And the intricacies of that are interesting and a tangent. I won't talk about them now. But his thinking about this was influenced by a report that he got, a correspondence about an American cuckoo species. And so here's what he says about this in the first edition. It's been asserted that the American cuckoo occasionally lays her eggs in other birds' nests, but I hear on the high authority of Dr. Brewer that this is a mistake. Nevertheless, and then he goes and outlines this scenario that I've just told you. Several editions later, he has new information and says, it has been both asserted and denied, ever the bet hedger that he is, that the American cuckoo occasionally lays her eggs in other birds' nests, but I've lately heard from Dr. Merrill of Iowa that he once found in Illinois. Those are totally irrelevant details, right? It just solidifies the possible veracity of the report. Report of a young cuckoo together with a young jay in the nest of a blue jay, and as both were nearly fully feathered, there could be no mistake in their identification. And as a bird person, those blue jay kids on the left there and American cuckoo, yellow-billed cuckoo on the right, they look nothing alike to me. If you don't live a life of birds, they may look the same to you. But I buy the idea that they weren't mistaken by a bird expert. So Darwin then takes this as some stronger evidence that maybe the American cuckoo really is at this earlier evolutionary stage of this scenario that he's been musing over. Okay, so he's a reviser, and he wanted to be right, he wanted to be convincing, he wanted to get the story right, and he wanted other people to believe that he had the story right. With that in mind, let's jump forward a few hundred years and revisit some things. And I guess I'll start with the fact that Darwin noticed a lot of patterns or problems for which there just weren't explanations in the 1800s, right? This shouldn't be a surprise or a disappointment, but there are things that we understand now. So here are an example or two. One huge thing that weighed on him, obviously, was the rarity of transitional fossils. If you're going to pose this scenario of lineages changing pretty drastically over long periods of time, there ought to be some evidence of that, not just point A and point B, but something somewhere in between. So the first Archaeopteryx was found in 1861, so 2 years after the first edition of Origin. So this is a primitive bird. It's probably not the ancestor of modern birds, but it is a branch of things related to modern birds. And this particular fossil was debated really heatedly, but not by Darwin, by Huxley, by Richard Owen, by others. But it really marked a turning point in evidence for this idea of descent with modification. And lots of transitional things have been found since then. One that made a splash in the last decade or so is Tiktaalik, which is a sort of a pre-transitional fish found by Neil Shubin and colleagues at the University of Chicago. Neil Shubin is like Neil deGrasse Tyson, a good popularizer of science. And Tiktaalik is transitional in the sense that it has limb architecture that makes it possible to imagine a shift from a fish to a land-based tetrapod. And so this was first found in 2006 and described really shortly thereafter, and then other things about it, like pelvic girdle structure, were just described in a lot of detail this year. So there's still neat things popping up all the time. And this really would be reassuring to Darwin, because as it says at the top, the absence of these things is, in his view, the most obvious and gravest objection against his theory. And he goes on to say, but in fact, I think it's a weakness in the fossil record that explains why we don't have these things. Not that they didn't exist, but they were relatively short-lived in time, probably rare in space, and we have no reason to think that we have even the majority, that we have examples of even the majority of things that have ever lived. Right, 99.9% of the species that ever lived on this planet are extinct. So if you're trying to reconstruct that history, if there are 10 million species now, do the math. That's a lot of things that aren't around anymore, that were around, and that are part of this historical picture. There's no reason to think that you'll find all of them. And so any effort at stitching together that pattern is going to be incomplete, and that's not a reason to doubt the parts of the pattern that you can shed light on. So other things that he noticed had to do with genetics. So here's an example of two things. Why the child often reverts in certain characters to its grandfather or grandmother or other much more remote ancestor. Why a peculiarity is often transmitted from one sex to both sexes or to one sex alone. So he's thinking about patterns of things that we now can explain with things like recessive traits, sex-linked inheritance. There are a lot of complex versions of sex-related inheritance. But these are all genetic phenomena that make great sense now, that explain things that he noticed. Being the style of writer that he wasn't going to not talk about these things just because he didn't have an explanation for them. So he was willing to put them out there and say, here's a pattern, don't have a great explanation for it, but it doesn't seem damaging to the bigger picture idea. Another sort of small one that he noticed, but that really is connected to a large, important concept, is this, that he noted that cats, which are entirely white and have blue eyes, are generally deaf. So there's an idea that now with a genetic framework we can understand called pleiotropy, where a single gene can influence the appearance of some pretty different kinds of traits, traits that would seem unrelated. If you understand the genetics and understand the developmental pathways involved, you can make sense of it. This is something akin to something called Wardenburg syndrome that you see in people. But the point, I guess, about this example is that it's, again, genetics and development, and that with a modern genetic background for thinking about development, a lot of our ideas have shifted a bit. The broader point is that Darwin was a keen observer of pattern. He was a critic of holes in his own ideas, and that the subsequent 150 years has shed light on most of those holes. Anybody that thinks and writes as widely as he does is certainly not going to be right all the time. So I'll turn briefly to an example or two of things that he maybe got wrong. And in a way, it just illustrates what a good thinker he was. So sexual selection is obviously the topic of not origin, but of descent. And he outlines what's now a familiar idea, which is that male ornaments, so the presence of ornaments or weapons on males, can be explained through variation in male mating success. So some males get a lot of mates, some males get few mates, and the difference is because of the ornaments that the females are choosing on, or the weapons that the males are using to gain access to places that the females are going to mate with males. The problem that Darwin recognized pretty shortly after coming to that sort of fundamental pattern was that there also are monogamous species that have male ornaments, and that this is true particularly of birds. So individuals have only one mate, meaning there's no scope for this male to get lots of mates because he he's the bright, flashy one, and this male to not get many mates because he's the dull one. All the males are getting one mate, all the females are getting one mate. So how do you explain the origin and maintenance of ornaments or of weapons in that kind of a system? And so here's the explanation that Darwin proposed. It's a little, it'll just take a minute to go through. So the idea is that females within a species, within a population, the individual females that are in really good condition, good body condition, are going to be more fecund. They're going to have higher reproductive output because of that. And that those females show up to breed early in the breeding season. So when they do that, all the males are there and available, and so the females pick the brightest, most ornamented guys. The bad-conditioned females, who, because of their bad condition, are going to be less fecund, lower reproductive output, show up later in the season, and who's left? All the dull, unattractive guys. And so everybody gets a mate, and so you'd think, well, everybody's happy, everybody got a mate, but of course the bright guys, bright-looking guys, are not the bright guys, sadly. The bright-looking guys are paired with females that are going to produce a lot of kids, and the dull-looking guys are paired with the females that are going to produce few kids. And so that mechanism could create variation in male success and pressure for the evolution of these kinds of ornaments, even though there's monogamy. And I've illustrated this again with frigate birds because they're awesome, and because I've thought about this particular idea in frigate birds. I don't know if it's surprising or not, but this is an idea that has really not gained much traction in 150 years. And I think Darwin was asking the right question, but maybe this wasn't the right answer. And maybe the right answer is this concept of extra pair matings, or what we sort of more judgmentally call infidelity. So here's the concept, if this is unfamiliar from the animal world. Within monogamous animals, within a monogamous pair bond, individuals could mate with each other, or they could mate with other individuals outside of the pair bond, but still work together to rear the kids that might or might not be their own, that might or might not be that guy's, really. The occurrence of this extra pair mating and its possible importance was foreseen by Robert Trivers during the sociobiology revolution of the early 1970s. But we didn't really have genetic tools to do paternity tests on animals until the late 80s. And so around that time, people's thinking about this really took off. Now, here's the kind of conceptual backstory to one of the puzzles in this. So if you make a graph of how many offspring you wind up with as a function of how many mates you have, of course, if you have zero mates, you have zero offspring. That's true for everybody. But for females, once you've got at least one mate, generally, you're not expected to produce more kids as a consequence of having more guys around. If females are egg-limited or limited in their ability to, in a placental mammal way, to nourish a certain number of developing embryos, having extra sperm from multiple males doesn't change that. From a male standpoint, more mates can mean more kids. So there's obviously a benefit for males to be interested in these extra pair matings, but it was less clear initially why females would want to participate in them. What does a female get out of this if she's not going to get more kids out of it the way a male does? So again, this is a realm where genetics really can help us, because it's not, from a female standpoint, not about more kids, but about better kids, and better kids in a genetic way. So one possibility is if you've got a female that has a multi-egg clutch or a multi-pup litter, then having multiple males as sires of those gives you genetically diverse offspring. This kid's got genes from this guy, this kid's got genes from the other guy, this kid's got genes from the milkman. And so in an unpredictable environment, you've got a diverse set of kids and you hope that some of them are going to make it somewhere. Again, sort of a bet hedging strategy. It's also possible that the extra pair male is better genetic quality than the male that you're paired to as a female, the male that you're saddled with as a female. And so you could either get genes for your kids for better survival, or if the extra pair male is an attractive male, then your sons might be attractive. And this sexy sons idea was something that got batted around a lot in the 80s. There's also a more subtle and sort of more interesting notion, and that is about genetic compatibility. And we all, you know, in human relationships, there's, in a personality way, we think about compatibility a lot. But there's genetic compatibility as well, in that the version of a gene that dad has and the version of the gene that mom has might play well together or might not, And it depends, the details of that depend on what the genes are for and how they work. I can talk at length about that later if people have questions. But the idea might be that for this female, that guy's a good fit. For this female, that guy's a good fit. And that's another area where this can be important. So it turns out that a lot of species have extra pair parentage. So these are on the horizontal axis is how many kids, what percent of kids in a population tend to be sired by somebody other than the guy that's taking care of them. So ranging from zero up to something shocking like 75. And then the vertical axis is just how many species of birds fall into those various bins. So there are a lot of species of birds, almost 40 in this sample, where there isn't any of this hanky-panky happening at all. And then there's species where it's sort of common, and then some species where it's really common. And this obviously sets a stage for conflict, because the male that's taking care of kids doesn't want to be doing that for kids that aren't his. And it turns out that the males don't have a way of looking at the kids or smelling the kids and figuring out if they're theirs or not. So just as a quick sidebar, these black-throated blue warblers, males try to prevent this by following their mates around when they're fertile and trying to prevent the females from having access to neighboring males. And so you can, a friend of mine did this experiment where you go into a black-throated blue warbler territory when the female is fertile and catch the male and just put him in a cage for an hour and then let him go again. And the extra pair parentage rate in broods from territories where he did that was almost 100%. So clearly there's conflict there that's created strong selection pressure. So the broader point here is about Darwin's thinking about sexual selection. And yeah, I think there's a different phenomenon that explains what he saw, but he recognized that it was something that needed to be explained. He recognized that it was something that was at odds with this basic pattern that made sense to everybody about deer or about sage grouse. So last thing I'll say is that sort of the big question then and now is how extensive is gradual natural selection as an agent of evolutionary change? And the short answer is that it's huge. It's usually the prevailing thing, and that's still true. There are plenty of cool cases where it's not true. So, for instance, some parts of the genome don't seem to affect survival or reproductive success, and instead they evolve not in a natural selection way, but in a more neutral, chance-driven way. You can have small populations of organisms where the impact of random events has a huge effect on which individuals contribute to the next generation and therefore on how traits change over time. Not natural selection driving that, but chance. You can have big scale changes in the genome. So in this gray tree frog, there are two kinds of gray tree frog in the eastern US that differ in the number of copies of their chromosomes that they have. And that happened in a very rapid event, in a single gamete-forming cell division failure that essentially instantly created a new species. Not gradual, not slow modification, but boom, sudden separation. So there are all kinds of cool things. There are cool examples about evolution of resistance to HIV, all kinds of things that are tweaks to the way that we've been thinking about things. But the bottom line is that the fundamentals are still the way Darwin imagined them. Lots of people love to criticize Darwin and to criticize evolution. They do that on religious grounds, which is certainly not surprising and intellectually usually not very interesting. There are also scientists that they have a flair for the melodramatic. They like to promote their work by sensationalizing it in sort of a Darwin was wrong kind of way. There was a recent last month article in the journal Nature called "Does Evolutionary Biology Need a Rethink?" And it's a side-by-side two articles written by different teams of people set up to argue about whether whether the discipline needs to be reframed. And the argument is, it's really about the relative importance of four phenomena. It's sort of about the public appreciation of four phenomena. And one is about the extent to which the way animals develop or plants develop constrains the directions that evolution can move those lineages in. A second is about the way organisms interact with their environment. Back to the leaf cutter. This is a great example. So the leaf cutters that were the subject of this amazing art installation. Leaf cutters like other creatures, are shaped by their environment, right? And that's evolution by natural selection. But they also shape their environment. They build these great crazy things and farm fungus. And so this interplay between living in a niche that's there and constructing a niche that's good for you is something that's interesting in the way people think about evolution now. Another one is that's getting bigger in importance is inheritance that goes beyond the way that we've been thinking about genetics for 100 years. And that includes things that are not genetically related at all, like socially transmitted behavior can be argued as heritable, and Richard Dawkins has written about memes and things that are in ways analogous to genes. But also epigenetics and changes to the genome that are passed on from parent to kid, but not by changing the letters of the DNA alphabet. But this argument, this and other things like it, really, to me, are sort of tempest in a teapot. Yeah, I get that these processes are happening and they're important, and I get that people can vary in how much they want to incorporate them in their thinking, but it doesn't really change the fundamentals. And that's the thing. People really want the attention of saying, well, let's rethink these things. And the field is definitely moving forward in exciting ways. But Darwin was right about tons of cool stuff. So he died in 1882. He's buried in Westminster Abbey, which is an interesting thing to contemplate at the time, given what his writings did in relation to the church. So, you know, in hindsight, through a scientific lens, although he was grudgingly accepted then, he really was remarkable. This is just a sample of books he wrote or edited. His scope was so wide. You know, I can stand up here and talk about how my work relates to Darwin. I think any biologist could. And so the thought I want to leave you with is that my friend Nat Wheelwright at Bowdoin has talked of making a stamp to use, not only when he's reading student papers, but when he's reading grant proposals and writings from other scientists. And that is that Darwin already thought of that. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council, with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and from friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.